just going to be a particular case of what we saw before, but we'll study it in lots of detail. So we have some wave function describing states of lattice of n sites. And we can always expand this wave function in terms of exponentially many coefficients. Okay. And so that's going to be this guy here. It's going to be this single tensor. And now what we're going to do is we're going to explore the possibility of representing wave functions or these exponentially many coefficients by using a one-dimensional array of tensors connected as in the drawing. So I guess I should put dot, dot, dot here. And then this is I1, I2, IN. And I'm going to consider, so I'm going to call this matrix product state for reasons that will become clear in a few minutes. And this would be a matrix product state with open boundary conditions, meaning that the n tensors don't talk to each other. But we could also consider the case where we connect the tensors like that. Okay? So that we would call it matrix product state with periodic boundary condition. Yay, they came. Very good. So then I want to start by making sure we understand what this represents. And so I'm going to start by considering a simple example. Oh, there's plenty of room here. Use it. So suppose that n is equal to 5. So now I'm going to write these tensors. I'm going to call them A, B, C, D, E. I'm giving them to each of the tensors. So there will be this Born index, alpha, that runs from 1 to chi. There are these physical indices, I5, running from 1 to D. Okay. So we have this collection of tensors. And then the question is, what happens if we fix the physical index? Okay. So let me say A, then, is a tensor with 5, 4, with 3 indices, alpha, beta, and I1. Okay. It has, as we said, it has chi square times d components. And what happens if we fix the physical index? Say we fix the physical index to taking value 1. Okay. Automatically, we have A alpha beta with fixed index 1. This is a matrix, right? It has 2 indices only. Okay? It's a matrix. Right? So then what we could imagine is that we're interested in understanding how much is the coefficient 2, 2, 1, 3, 1. Okay? Well, we just take all these matrices and we fix these tensors, and we fix the indices. So let me first draw it like that. A, B, C, D, E. But now this index is going to be fixed to 2. This index is going to be fixed to 2. This index is going to be fixed to 1. This index is going to be fixed to 3. This index is going to be fixed to 1. Okay. So what happens when we fix the indices? Well, the indices disappear. Right? But I'm going to just leave the index signaled in here, meaning that they have a matrix called A2, matrix called B2, matrix called C1, matrix called D3, and E1. And the idea is that now what we have is a product of matrices. Okay? This is actually the trace. It's the trace of A2, B2, C1, D3, E1. Okay? So a matrix product state is a tensor network that expresses individual coefficients of the wave function. Okay? This is a complex number. It expresses this D to the N coefficients, but each of them as a product or as the trace of a product of matrices. And that's why we call it matrix product state. It's a state that it expresses a product of matrices. So, or if you want to know how much is one of these components, this one, for instance, you multiply these matrices. If you want to know how much is instead this component, you come here and replace C1 with matrix C3. Okay? So you can think of this tensor as an array of the different matrices. Right? This is a tensor, it's an array that contains one matrix, another matrix, and all the way to D. Very good. So this I hope, well, I'm trying to go slowly here, but I hope it's clear. We have a proposed way of representing wave functions, which consists in a one-dimensional array of tensors. It's very clear what it means that we can extract the d to the n components from this tensor network. Okay? Every time you want a specific component, just fix the physical indices that turns the tensor network into a product, the trace of a product of matrices. You compute that, you get the complex number you wanted. You could do this for D to the N different combinations of matrices. Okay? Very good, so now we have our checklist. Okay? We want to ask the typical questions, A, B, C. And I will ask the question and hopefully you'll answer. So, efficiency. So, A, efficient specification. Efficient, how many parameters do we have in that? Okay, so I will start this for you. Each tensor is has these three indices and chi denotes the size of a bond index. By the size, I mean how many different values it takes. So we have the bond indices are dimension chi, and the physical index is dimension d, takes the different values. And so how many complex parameters can we store here? This tensor depends on how many entries do we have? Is it too easy again? Yeah, too easy. Okay. So somebody who thinks it's too easy, how much?
Chi squared and d.
Very good. So, okay. So these are our variational parameters. We can change them, and then the wave function will change. And we have n of those. So total number of coefficients is order, it goes as n d chi square. Okay? So good, we have an efficient representation. But we learned that that's necessary but not sufficient. That there is a, that we have to be careful about efficient manipulation. Okay? So for that, I want to discuss how we compute this scalar product of an NPS with itself. And I want to discuss how we compute the expectation value of a local observable. So let's start with the scalar product. How do we what we want first is a tensor network representation for this. Okay. And this is a tensor network representation for the ket. And this is for the bra. So this is the ket, this is the bra, and now the scalar product is obtained by contracting these indices. Okay? So this is a tensor network representation of the scalar product. And now we need to contract this to get a number out of it, right? There are no open legs, so this is a number, as it should be. And the question is, how do we compute this guy? And I'm going to describe two strategies. One is going to be bad. One strategy is say, OK, this is psi. I'm going to contract these indices together so I can produce the wave function. I'm going to also contract these indices together so I get the bra, the ket, and the bra. They should have the same number of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Now that I've built these guys, I'm going to take this, the scalar problem. Okay? I'm going to multiply these two vectors together. Okay. So what would be the cost of doing that? Okay. Why do I call this a bad strategy? Anybody?
Scales exponentially.
Why?
Because you're contracting it again into a full wave function in the normal stupid sense for which.
Okay. So this object is d to the n. This is d to the n, right? And now we'll have to multiply a vector d to the n times d to the n. Okay, so that's true in general with tensor networks. Even though you could, in principle, recover the exponentially many coefficients, never do that. Okay? So you have to find a way of manipulating the tensor network, which does not require building the full wave function. Because if you have to build a full wave function, then what's the point of working with tensor networks? At that point, this cost is necessarily exponential. So instead, what we're going to do is we're going to use the good strategy. And the good strategy, I'll give you version 1, which is pretty good. And then this afternoon, you have to work on the optimal good strategy. So the idea is that if I want to compute this scalar product, I could. The pretty good strategy says, let's convert that into this product. So what do I mean by this? I'm going to take these two tensors, and I'm going to multiply them together. Okay? And the result of that will be this tensor here, which is now, if I join this tensor, so this tensor has 4 bond indices. And if I join these indices together and these indices together, what I get is something that looks like a matrix with a thick index. So what do I mean by thick or thin or whatever? Well, if this was dimension chi and this was dimension chi, then this is dimension chi squared. Okay. You can put together two indices, and the dimension will be multiplied. So what that means is that I can imagine that this is just then this. This one-dimensional array of tensors, which are now matrices, where the bond dimension is chi squared. So what we have is vector times matrix times matrix times matrix times matrix times matrix times vector. Okay? But the good news is that we know how to do matrix multiplications without building bigger objects than the matrices themselves. So what I mean is that we could start, the good strategy will say, let's multiply these two guys together. Okay? So this is a vector matrix multiplication. Okay? And this is, this dimension is chi square. This is chi square. So how much is this matrix vector multiplication going to cost us? How much does it take? Computational time. Anybody? Is that still too easy? Remember that if we had a matrix and a vector, and this was dimension m, then the cost of this was m squared. Now it's so easy, nobody wants to answer, right?
Yeah, each time you do like a matrix multiplication, it's a matrix with wait.
This matrix here is chi squared times chi squared, right?
I mean, it's linear in n, that's the point.
Sorry?
It's linear in n, that's the point.
But no, I want to know this operation here. What's the cost of this operation? Multiplying the vector times the matrix. Anybody?
Okay, just say.
It's what you get by doing that. So the vector is now this vector. This is a vector. It has only one index, but this index takes chi square value. So it's chi dimensional, and then you have a chi square times chi square matrix. And so it's going to be the cost of doing this operation. Cost time, it's going to scale as chi to the 4, right? It's m squared, chi to the 4. Okay? Very good. So there is some cost, chi to the 4. And the important thing is that once we've multiplied these two together, what do we get? Well, if this was if we multiply these two together, we produce a new vector, right? And now this vector is still chi squared dimensional. So we started with a chi squared dimensional vector multiplied by a matrix, chi squared times chi squared. Now we obtain as a result a vector of the same size, so nothing exploded yet. And now what we need to do is multiply again times a matrix of the same size. So the cost of each of such operations is always the same. It's chi to the 4, right? So in going from here to here, it's chi to the 4. But now in contracting again, it's chi to the 4. And as Nick was saying, how many times do we have to do this? Order n. So that's really good news. Total cost of computing this expectation value is order n chi 4. Okay? So linear in the system side.
Why are you contracting like this and then like that and not like eating it up like from one side?
Because I call this a pretty good strategy.
Okay.
Now the optimal strategy and the one that you'll have to work in the tutorial today, so that is square, perfect. Tutorial. You'll show that actually you can do better than that. You'll show that you can go with n chi 3, d or something. Okay? That's going to be you, not me. Okay? So at the very least, we've seen that we can compute the scalar product with a cost that is only linear in the system size. And remember, that is avoiding the bad strategy, where the bad strategy is to actually build a wave function. Now, this is what's going to happen all the time. We will be able to extract information from the wave function without ever putting all the tensors of the wave function together. Okay? Very good. So, scalar product, very good. Now, what else do we want to be able to compute? So if all you can do is to say that the norm, wow, I broke it. All right. So if all we can say is that we can efficiently compute the scalar product of a vector, that's not enough. We need to do other things. We may want to compute the expectation value of some insertion of some operator. So how does this look like as a tensor network? Well, again, ket, bra. Now insertion. Somewhere at type n, and then let's contract this. Okay. Now, what's clear from this description is that if I just take this part here and I contract it together into a into a single. Answer. Then, after that step, we are back to. We just need to do this again, right? So we can just contract all these tensors vertically, and then we're back to whatever calculation we had to do for the scalar product. And the obvious observation is that this is not order n. This does not scale with n. It's just some manipulation. Since we're here, we are going to compute it. So this is dimension chi. This is dimension chi. This is chi. This is chi. And this one is d. So, and this is d. So this times this, if you remember from previous lectures, we just need to multiply the size of all the indices involved. So this multiplying first this together, it's going to be cos chi squared d squared. And then we'll have some tensor that looks like this now, where is this. And again, this is chi, and d. And so this contracting this together into here, it's going to cost us chi 4 times d. So no dependence on n, obviously. And so what we see is that we can compute this expectation value with something that scales in n as chi 4. As for the scalar product. And when I say one insertion, could have with many insertions. So if we wanted to compute a 2-point expectation value, or later, or 3-point later, 4-point later, we just put as many insertions as we want. These were observed in the step where we multiply vertically, and we end up always with the same structure, which we can efficiently compute or contract with a cost order n chi 4. Okay? And for every time I say order n chi 4, this afternoon you'll learn how to do it order n chi 3. Very good. Is that clear? If it's clear, now I want to tell you what happens when we introduce a symmetry, translation invariance, into this description. Because then we'll be able to do everything that I said with a cost that is independent of n. Okay? And if it's independent of n, the system size, nothing will prevent us from going and taking the thermodynamic limit and suddenly having a description of a wave function for an infinite system with order one coefficient, and being able to extract information at a cost order one. Some fixed cost. So let me describe how this works. So we are done showing that the matrix product state can be efficiently It's an efficient representation that can be efficiently manipulated. At least we've tested this for a specific manipulation, say norm computing the norm or a one point correlator, 2-point correlators, and so on. Once you have this ability, in particular, you could use that to compute the expectation value of the Hamiltonian. Right, the Hamiltonian is a sum of local terms. For each local term, you can compute the expectation value. Maybe I want to say this explicitly. Given those abilities, now we could use those to compute the expectation value of, say, the Hamiltonian, which is nothing, if it's a local Hamiltonian, is nothing but the sum psi of local terms, L plus 1. Now, for each local term, what we will have is a tensor network that will look a bit more complicated. Maybe it's two-body term. It's not single psi, right? So. So we would have to say the Hamiltonian term is here. Okay, so there will be some locally slight more complexity, but it's independent of n, again, this particular cost. So we can multiply vertically again. And what I'm saying is that we have the ability to efficiently evaluate the expectation value of a Hamiltonian. And this is really what you need, all you need if you want to have a variational approach. If you compute, if you choose, you first choose all the tensors, all the tensors are full of variational parameters, right? Or they're n chi squared times d variational parameters. And you can choose them initially randomly. Then for that choice of variational parameters, you have an efficient way of computing the expectation value of the Hamiltonian. So that will tell you how much is the energy of that particular choice of variational parameter. And now you could, for instance, start changing a little bit the variational parameters and see whether that, and computing the energy again, and see whether the energy is increasing, decreasing, staying the same. And you can have this simple rule that if the energy goes down a little bit, you keep the change of the variational parameters. And if the energy was going up, you don't change the variational parameters. You try a different variation of the, you keep changing the variational parameters and only accepting the changes if the energy is going down. Okay. This is the simplest way of trying to look for the ground state. You keep changing your variational parameters, and every time the change brings you down in energy, you accept the change. And you keep doing that. Okay. Of course, there are much better, much more sophisticated ways of doing this, that of optimizing, of looking for the ground state. But they are based on the same principle. If you have the ability to compute the energy, then you have the ability to look for what choice of variational parameters is lowering this energy. So with a matrix product state, now we would have the ability to look for what state within this tensor network class gets the lowest possible energy for a given Hamiltonian, and then we'll take that as our approximation to the ground state of that system. So what I was going to do then is to say, fine, we can manipulate, we can optimize efficiently the matrix product state, but let's look at what happens if we, on top of that, add translation invariance. And so, translation invariance. So imagine that we have that we're interested in a Hamiltonian that commutes with a translation operator. Then we expect the ground state to also be translation invariant. And a good answer for that, so we expect if the ground state is unique, it will be invariant in the translations. And in that case, what we will take as an answer is an MPS with, in this case, it's periodic boundary conditions, so that this Hamiltonian, if it's invariant in the translations, it means shifts, right? We need periodic. We need to work on the circle. We cannot work on the line. The Hamiltonian cannot be translation invariant on the line. There is no notion of that there. So what we're going to choose is that all the tensors in the MPS be the same. Okay. So there is a wave function. It is completely characterized by a single tensor. And you know how to extract all the coefficients for the wave function. Just this, each tensor is a set of d matrices, a1, a2, ad, and we'll do the same that we said before, how to compute all the exponentially many coefficients. That would be the same that we discussed for a, b, c, d, e in that case, but we would replace all the tensors by the same tensor a. Okay? So the whole wave function, which depends on d to the n coefficients, now is codified in chi squared d coefficients. Okay? So that's a super efficient way of doing that. It's order 1. So how does this scale with n? Order 1. Very good. Now, how do we compute, in this case, the expectation value? Or say, how do we manipulate this tensor network in a way that does not depend on n? Okay? That's what we want to discuss. So this was A, efficient manipulation. Too many A's at the moment, but the specification, specification, it's independent of the system size. And then B, manipulation. So let's start with the norm. Now the norm will be this tensor network, as before. Before we saw open boundary conditions, now I'm looking at anti-periodic boundary conditions. But it's the difference will, the important difference is not whether I have this index here, but whether these tensors are the same or not. OK, so the idea is the following, that suppose I give you a matrix M, and I ask you how much is the trace of M to the nth power. Okay? There are two strategies you can follow to compute this. One is you take M and you multiply it N times. And then you take the trace. Okay? And as a function of N, the cost scales is order N, right? We need to multiply the matrix n times. Okay. Maybe we could do it better. Maybe we could multiply it pairwise. And then maybe we can reduce this to log n. But I don't want to discuss that. The point is that there is some dependence of n. If there is dependence in n, it's going to be hard to take n input. Okay. But another thing we can do is we can diagonalize n. So this is what we're going to do. So given a matrix, we can compute its eigenvalue decomposition. And this I'm going to represent in this way, sum over alpha of what I'm going to call right eigenvalues and left, eigenvectors and right and left eigenvectors. So usually we're used to diagonalizing Hermitian matrices or normal matrices where the left and the right eigenvectors are the conjugate of each other. But for a generic matrix, that property is not going to be there. The only property we'll have is that left alpha and right, left alpha, right beta is going to be delta alpha beta. Okay. But we don't have that left alpha, left beta is equal to delta alpha beta. Okay. We don't have this, and we don't have the same for. Okay. So given this decomposition, then we can compute m to the n, or m squared. M squared, you can convince yourself, is alpha, beta, lambda alpha, lambda beta, and then we have R alpha, L beta, L alpha, R beta, L beta. Okay, and now we use the only property we have here is this delta. We can use it here, this delta alpha beta. And so this is as we expected, or as it just written as L alpha squared. Right alpha, left alpha. Okay. So if you, this is the eigenvalue decomposition. Eigenvalue decomposition of some generic matrix M. What I'm saying is that obviously, well, as expected, if you square the matrix, then you get that the eigenvalues are squared. And so we know that M to the N is nothing but take the eigenvalues to the nth power, and then right alpha, left alpha. Okay. So if we know that, then we can take the trace, right? Trace of mn is going to be a sum over alpha of lambda alpha to the n. Okay. So what I've done is I've just computed the trace of m to the nth power without actually multiplying the matrices n times. I just diagonalize them. Is that clear? So that's going to be very useful in a minute. But let me go on. So now we are going to assume that lambda 1 is larger than lambda 2. So these are the eigenvalues of m. And we're going to assume that the largest one is larger than the others, not equal, but strictly larger, okay? In absolute value. Okay. Then what will happen here, could sound familiar, is that this is going to be, we can always write it as lambda 1 of 1 plus to the nth power of 1 plus lambda 2, lambda 1 to the nth power, etc. Okay. And because this is a number, so because lambda 2 over lambda 1, the modulus is smaller than 1, following from here, okay, what we'll see is that this trace is equal to the largest eigenvalue to the nth power times 1 plus corrections that decay exponentially in n. So what that means is that if when we take the thermodynamic limit n going to infinity, we will even be able to simplify this a lot, because this will be equal to lambda 1 to the n when n goes to infinity. Okay, so what I'm saying is that not only we can do things with a cost that is independent of n, but actually we can take the n to infinite limit, and things will simplify. So I've been talking about some metrics that of which we want to take the trace of the product or of the nth power. But of course, these metrics, what I had in mind was that this metric m was this unit here. Okay. So what is this? This was, remember, A, there is some A star, but this is also A star. So I have some metrics, I call it the metrics from left to right. I'm going to join these two indices, and so on. And this is going to look exactly like this. Is it clear? I'm going to call this the MPS transfer metric. MPS transfer metric. T is going to be A star. Okay, that's my definition. And then what I'm saying is that the expectation value or the norm of the MPS now is trace of T to the nth power. Okay. So the norm is going to be the dominant eigenvalue of matrix T to the nth power up to plus 1 plus exponentially suppressed corrections. Okay. So I can diagonalize, I can compute the norm in the thermodynamic limit. All I need to do is to look to build these metrics. It's a matrix from left to right, right? I need to, in my head, I join these indices. Now this looks like a metric. I diagonalize this metric. That comes with a cost that doesn't know about the system size n, some fixed amount. And then I look at the largest eigenvalue, and to the nth power, that would give me the norm of the state. Of course, it's going to be 0 or infinite or 1, right? If you take some number. So this eigenvalue, if this eigenvalue was 1, exactly 1, then 1 to the nth power is 1. If it's smaller than 1, or the norm is, its absolute value is smaller than 1, the norm is going to be 0, right? The nth power is going to, in the limit of n going to infinity, is going to give you only 2-3 possible results, 0, 1, or infinite. But the point is that we'll get this value. I don't know what's happening today. Oh. point is that once we have lambda 1, we can go back to our tensor network, and we can define a normalized tensor, A tilde, by taking A and dividing it by the square root of lambda 1. And now you ask, what's the, so in this case, the expectation value of the state, which has been normalized. You can check that it's again the trace, but now of this normalized transfer metric. Okay. And now it's equal to lambda 1 tilde to the nth power, but lambda 1 tilde by construction now is 1. Okay. So we've been able to normalize the state analytically, in the sense that we didn't have to multiply to contract a tensor network. We just had to build these transfer metrics and look at what's the largest eigenvalue. OK? Good. So what else? That normalizes the state for us. Are there questions? So the next thing is, can we compute expectation value? The next question is, also in the thermodynamic limit in this case. So how much would be sigma x on site n? Okay. Now it would have to draw a tensor network for this, and it's going to be, again, of this form. With an insertion somewhere here. And this looks like, take the trace of the transfer metric and put some sigma somewhere. Okay, but in the thermodynamic limit, we know how to do that again, because if you want, we don't even need to use the thermodynamic limit first. So this is going to be the sum over alpha. We already know what, now we know what t, the transfer metric to the n power, is going to be lambda alpha to the nth power, where lambda 1 now is 1 by normalization with normalized state. So the largest eigenvalue is 1. And then we'll have the right alpha and left alpha eigenvectors. So then this thing is going to be equal to alpha sigma right alpha lambda alpha to the nth power. Okay. We've done this analytically. Again, we don't have to multiply the matrices explicitly. But this, in the thermodynamic limit, will give us the only non-zero contribution. So now n going to infinity will be, what do I want to do? I want to say that this is equal to, right. So remember that lambda 1 was the largest eigenvalue. So that means that lambda 2, the modulus of this, is already smaller than 1. So, and the same for the rest of lambdas. So these guys all decay exponentially to 0, except for, so now I'm going to say, I'm going to infinity. It is going to be just lambda 1, which is 1, the nth power, left alpha, left 1, sigma, right 1. Okay. All we need to know is what's the dominant eigenvector, left and right eigenvectors, of the transfer metric. This is the final result. So again, to make this, the derivation involves some n's, but in the end, all I need to compute, given the transfer matrix T, is I need to find what's the right dominant eigenvector defined as the one that has eigenvalue 1, and what's the left dominant eigenvector, which is the one that has eigenvalue 1. Okay, so given t, find this eigenvector, that eigenvector, compute this expectation value. That's order one. That doesn't require the system. Okay? So again, we can compute expectation values efficiently. Okay, with order one cost, doesn't scale with n. So that's how we can deal with infinite systems in this case. Are there questions about this? Because if not, then I'll move to discussing. Can I have the screen, please? That they are. Okay. So then I want to move to discussing what an MPS, why we should expect the MPS to be a good approximation to ground states. And remember that we wanted to check, so that's part C, we wanted to check structural properties. Of this variational class. So if a wave function can be written as an MPS, automatically it may have certain properties, and those were correlations, a decay in some way, and the entanglement entropy, which will scale in some way as well. Okay. Very good. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to stick to the case where we have translation invariants. I'm going to do that for simplicity. I'm just going to look at what are the implications for a wave function if it can be written as an MPS, which is translation invariant. So it's a single tensor A, so I put many copies of it. And in the thermodynamic limit. So I don't need to worry about the system size anymore. Okay. Very good. So what I want to do first is to look at how a two-point correlator scales. But for that, let me review. I'm going to repeat what I just explained to you for the norm and for the one-point insertions, but I'm going to do it just with diagrams so that the discussion is simplified. Okay, so I'm not going to tell you anything new in the next 2 minutes. I'm just going to rephrase what I said before, but with diagrams. So here, it is the answers that we're considering with each tensor being a copy of A. We have n copies of the same tensor. The scalar product will be this. Okay? The transfer matrix that we were talking about will be this one. And so this is an eigenvalue decomposition, a graphical representation of the eigenvalue decomposition, right? There are left eigenvalues, eigenvectors, right eigenvectors, and the eigenvalues. This is the relation that the left eigenvector satisfies, that when I multiply with the transfer matrix, gives it back itself times the corresponding eigenvalue. And now, you can see that clearly, right? Okay. And so what I was saying is that when we want to compute the norm, we just need to know the dominant eigenvector, left and right dominant eigenvectors of the transfer matrix, because that's what dominates this calculation. And we assume this is normalized to 1, and then the corrections are exponentially suppressed in n. So this is a good approximation at large n, and it's an exact result at infinite n. And then what we've been saying is that when we have the expectation value of 1 point, right, that's the insertion, then we can imagine that what we have is that the rest of the tensor network, again, can be replaced with a resolution of the identity for the transfer matrix, but we need only to keep the dominant eigenvector. And so that's the final result, okay? Just expressed in diagrams. Plus, again, corrections that are exponentially suppressed in n and are 0, therefore, in the thermodynamic limit. And now what I want to do, if this notation is clear, is I want to discuss a two-point correlator. Okay. So what we want to compute now is how correlation scale by inserting two operators. And the idea is that first we will take this, all these times, these are copies, it's the transfer matrix to some large power. And we'll play the trick that we've been playing, that we'll replace it with the dominant eigenvalue and dominant eigenvectors. And so if we do that, we'll get this expression here, where all I've done is I've taken this product of the transfer matrix 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 times. I assume that 8 is very large. And I've replaced that part of the tensor network with the right and left dominant eigenvectors. Okay? So that is equivalent to what we've been doing. And there are, therefore, corrections exponentially suppressed with this number 8 of sites that I talked about, which would be infinite in the thermodynamic limit. So I hope that this step is clear, that if I want to compute this two-point correlator, what I need to do is to contract this tensor network. And now this tensor network has a very interesting shape, because I'm trying to understand a two-point correlator between insertions at point 0 and L. So the distance between here and here is L. There are L different sites. Okay. And what I see is that this looks like some vector and some other vector and the transfer matrix to the L minus 1 power. Okay. So we have a transfer matrix in between that mediates. So you know, we have to this two-point correlator will be the result of applying this transfer matrix order L times. And then whenever you have this type of situation, you should expect an exponential decay of correlations. But let me walk you through that. So this is here. And by the way, these are the notes that you have from the wiki. Okay. So, you probably could have them in your laptop right now. So what I'm saying is that this thing here is the transfer matrix, and it appears L to the minus 1 time. So the expectation value that we want, this two-point correlator, is the result of some left vector on the left that depends on the insertion, some vector on the right that depends on the insertion. So this knows about what operator we are computing the correlator of. And some piece in here, which is just L or L minus 1 power of this transfer matrix. But now what we can do is we can take the transfer matrix, MPS transfer matrix, and write it in its eigenvalue decomposition. Okay. And that's what we've done here. So this means we will have, you know, alpha goes from 1 to chi squared. That's because there are the product of these indices, each one taking chi values. So there are chi square values. OK, so now what we're going to do is we're going to split this sum of chi squared values into two terms. The first one is alpha equal to 1. Okay. And then the second part is the rest of terms that are chi squared minus 1 term. Okay. And the observation is that this first term here corresponds to the expectation value of just having this insertion times the expectation value of having the other insertion alone. Okay? If you go through this, you'll realize that this is the product of expectation values of one insertion and the other insertion. Whereas this term here will account for correlation. So this will be weighted by the subdominant eigenvalues. There was an eigenvalue here which was 1, so I didn't write it. And then there are the rest of eigenvalues, which come with to the elf power. Okay? So that's it. We know the scaling now. Because what we need to do is, if we ask for the connected correlator, we've been discussing this piece and gave us two contributions. But now we want to discuss this minus that, and that corresponds precisely to this part. So when we subtract the two pieces, right, when we ask for the connected correlator of the expectation value of two insertions at distance L, what we get is this part. And this part has a very simple structure. It's, you know, these are numbers. These are some numbers that you can compute. And then what we are interested in is in the scaling with L, with the distance between the two insertions. And these insertions this dependent is written here. It's some eigenvalue to the nth power. So that's what we have here, that the two-point correlator is some number, some amplitude, times a factor to the nth power. But every time you have a factor, remember, these numbers have modulus smaller than 1. So this is an exponential suppression that we have. And so this is this you know, let's call this thing mu of alpha. And then the rest is exponential of minus L to some characteristic length scale. So the idea is that when you compute two-point correlator for an MPS, you have the result is an exponential decay of correlations. Or more correctly, is a sum of different exponentials. Okay, you get exponential decay for each eigenvalue of the transfer matrix that is not equal to 1. So you have to sum over those. But obviously, still, when you have a sum over exponentials at long distances, there will be exponential that dominates over the rest. Right. So if I tell you I have exponential of minus L plus exponential of minus 2L, right? At long distances, this goes as u to the L. This one decays much faster than this one. Okay? So there will be a dominant correlation length there, and that will precisely correspond to the one coming from the second largest eigenvalue of the transfer matrix. Okay? The largest eigenvalue of the transfer matrix is 1 by normalization, and the second one, second largest eigenvalue, is going to give us the correlation length that will dominate. We have exponential decay of correlations with a correlation length that is given by precisely, it's hidden somewhere here. It's going to be minus 1 over the log of the second largest eigenvalue of the transfer matrix. So the conclusion is that we have this variational class of states, this tensor network. And if we consider the homogeneous case in which we put all the tensors to be the same, it follows without having optimized the variational parameters, without having tried to get to a good approximation to some ground state. We didn't specify any Hamiltonian here. And yet we were already able to derive that the correlations decay exponentially, which is the same that we observe in ground states of gap systems in one dimension. Okay? So that's what I call a structural property of the variational class, of the tensor network class. It's not of the optimized instance of a tensor network. It's just if you can write a wave function as a transition invariant matrix product state, it will have exponential decay of correlation. We just derived that. Okay? Very good. So it's time, and we are all very hungry, so I will continue now. Now, I just want to say one more thing, and then we're done. I want to talk about correlations. Entanglement, sorry, I want to talk about entanglement entropy, okay? I want to explain, and you will see this in the tutorial in more detail, that if you have a wave function, psi, represented by a matrix product state, how are we going to compute the reduced density matrix? Well, we, of a region, we're going to put psi, Brahm, psi ket, right? And then we're going to trace out all the spins corresponding to the complement of region A. So in this case, you can imagine this is region A. Okay, this open lattice corresponds to the sites on region A, and the sites that are not in region A, we trace them. Right, tracing means connecting the branket index. So this would be a tensor network representation. Ignore the red dot for the time being. This would be a tensor network representation for the reduced density matrix on these sites. And the observation is that I can split this density matrix. This density matrix has correlation between the Brahm and the ket. But the Brahm and the ket pieces are only connected through two bond indices. I can break this tensor network into two pieces, one that refers to the Brahm, one that refers to the ket, by cutting only two indices. And this afternoon in the tutorial, you will learn that this implies that the entropy that we can have for this reduced density matrix is upper bounded. It can be at most two times, one per index, two times the log of the dimension of the index. So I have it somewhere here. We will learn that the entropy of a region of size A region A can be at most log of the bond dimension of the MPS times 2. Okay? We will see this afternoon, but the conclusion then is that this is a constant, so this is the area law in 1 plus 1 dimension. So we haven't optimized any variational parameter, and we have seen two things about an MPS, which is transition invariant. First, correlations decay exponentially. Second, the entropy saturates to a constant. It's at most some constant. And this is a match with the properties of ground state of gap Hamiltonians in one dimension. Okay? But this is not the proof that a matrix product state is a good representation of ground states in 1 plus 1 dimension. But it's compatible with that. Yes?
Since it's this doesn't just show that it's bounded by some constant, it gives you a very, very specific constant.
Perfect.
Does that also mean that we need to make chi bigger than e to the power, whatever that constant is in the actual system divided by 2?
Yeah. So you've learned the ground states when you look at the entanglement spectrum. There were large eigenvalues, the p alphas, there were large ones and smaller ones. And this guy is telling you where you're going to cut. And so if the concrete ground state is such that there are many probabilities that are significant, not sufficiently small, then you will need chi to be large enough to still capture all those. So the given a ground state of a gap Hamiltonian in one dimension, given a ground state that we want to represent, if we want to represent it with a matrix product state, it may require some value of chi. Maybe 10 is not going to be good enough for this particular ground state. Maybe we'll need to go to 20. Yeah. So the one dimension that we need will depend on the ground state we're trying to represent. Yes?
And in a critical system, I guess the chi needed would go to infinity, right?
Yes, if you want an infinite
if
system.
You want.
But then the important question is what happens if you don't take chi infinite? How good an approximation, how bad an approximation you get? Okay? Very good. So this completes the theory part of today's tensor network marathon. But there is an afternoon tutorial.